I just want to say a quick thanks to everyone who has left a podcast review so far. It's been fantastic to see what you guys are making of the podcast and really enjoy reading them. Rest assured, I do read every single one. So thanks again. And if you haven't left a review yet, it would do us a massive favor if you would, as that would help us grow this community and reach more grassroots coaches who will benefit from these conversations. So thanks again, and we really appreciate it.
Welcome to the Athletic Evolution Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Andy Taylor. Andy was a professional footballer for nearly 10 years, starting at Manchester United and then moving on to Exeter City. He completed a foundation degree in sports performance at the University of Bath and a first-class honours degree in strength and conditioning at the University of Plymouth, St Mark and St John. This, combined with his practical work with young athletes over the last 6 years, based at Iverbridge Community College, has allowed him to put this knowledge into action.
So, welcome to the podcast, Andy. It's great to have you today.
Thanks, Rob. Really grateful for you having me on. Appreciate it.
So for those who haven't come across you day to day, give us a bit of an overview of the journey of how you got involved in sport and how that's kind of developed into a career and what you're doing today.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think I was probably lucky enough to be brought up in a pretty active environment where I lived. There was a lot of kids on our street, so plenty of time for play. The street would be full of kids of all ages. I had older brother and sister, so all their kind of friends came together. So having the opportunity to play against a range of age groups, and kickabouts in the street and all sorts of different games kind of really led me into being physically active, but also kind of, I suppose, kind of picking up some skills for sport and kind of having to deal with different challenges of certainly playing against your older siblings, but their friends as well. So yeah, my kind of love for football kind of started then. It was, I think, Italia 90, which I can look back on, and that being probably the spearhead of me having a passion for football, and then kind of being taken to my local club by my dad and my brother being involved in football at the time. That kind of led me down that path, and it's something that I love to do, and as it kind of formulated, it turned into a professional career. So it was a great time, and I kind of look back in fond memories of the environment that I grew up in.
So what sort of time period was it in your life when you first had contact from a professional football club and were looking at you know, being signed and going down that route?
Difficult from where I come from, which is right down in the southwest, which is where I live now, so I'm kind of back home again. We're kind of out on a limb. So at the time, the rules were that you couldn't go to a professional football club until you were 14. That was further than an hour and a half from your home. So I actually was seen at 11, and I think it was Queen's Park Rangers at the time. There was a scout in the area that had kind of picked me up from a tournament that I was playing in, and kind of kept in contact. And then those scouts kind of moved over to Tottenham Hotspur at the time, because the manager moved over. So I ended up going to Tottenham at the age of 13, which was a little bit ahead of the time that I should have done. But started my journey into a professional football club, and that was always what would have been needed to have been done from where I live, is that expectation to travel, and that was kind of instilled in me from a young age from parents, that, you know, if that's a path that I wanted to follow, that's something that we'd have to kind of deal with. So yeah, that's how it started.
And then what were the kind of movements on from Spurs?
So yeah, I spent a year there. My dad actually contacted Manchester United when I was a 7-year-old, So he must have seen someone very early because he contacted and said, look, I think my son's got a talent. And they probably thought, yeah, right, we get many seven-year-old dads calling us, saying the same thing. But kept in contact. And when I started to go to Tottenham, they kind of realised that I must have something to be going there. So they decided to come and watch eventually. And like what they saw, and I was signed on my 14th birthday. So, which was a bit of a dream come true because I'm a Manchester United fan. So to go to the club that you support, it was, yeah, a bit of a fantasy really.
So what did that entail at 14? I'm imagining it wasn't a case of traveling anymore. Did you move to Manchester's facilities or what was the story?
No, so I began to go up on a weekend. It wasn't necessarily every weekend, so I would still play with my local club on the weekends that I didn't go up. I was involved in an independent centre of excellence in the area, so the club were happy that I was still getting a relatively high quality level of coaching, and then would go up in the holidays throughout the year and spend a few days and train and play games, and that was the same up until kind of under 15 age, where I would go up then every weekend. I would leave school early on a Friday, travel up on the train, and then play either on a Saturday for the year above, and then Sunday with my own age group as well. So, and that was until the age of 16. And then when I finished my GCSEs, then it was time to move up to Manchester and start my apprenticeship.
So what kind of challenges were there for you? I'm imagining, you know, if there's a heck of a lot of excitement in someone getting a shot at, you know, not just a football club, but arguably one of the biggest in the world, and particularly at that point in time.
Yep.
You know, certainly the, you know, winning premierships and winning FA Cups and being, you know, having people, significant players in you know, household names, etc. That must have been a dream come true. But I'm imagining also there would have been some challenges environmentally and, you know, at the age of 15, moving city, you know, from, as you say, somewhere that's, you know, quite different in the southwest to somewhere that's maybe a bit more metropolitan and a bit more city-like. Yeah. What was that like?
It was a challenge. And I had a challenge before that at the kind of age of 14. So in my end of my first year at the club, when I signed as a 14-year-old, I had a condition that was picked up in my knee, which caused me a problem. And I ended up having to kind of miss playing for 6 months in order to try and rectify that. So that was difficult from a young age, trying to deal with that. Something that you're really passionate about and that you just want to do, and you see all your friends playing, and obviously you feel like, am I missing out on my development because other players are now, you know, getting ahead of me? So having to deal with that, and then the transition also as well of leaving home, you know, staying with a family, although the families that we got to stay with were pretty amazing. And it was almost a home from home, but still it's not like being at home. And that is a difficult transition to make, but one that you know you have to, if that's the path that you want to follow. So although that's difficult, you try to learn some strategies, but you don't necessarily have those tools to deal with it. And maybe that's something that maybe clubs are getting better at now. There's certainly an education program that's much better suited to kind of deal with these issues, which I think is important.
So I guess stepping into that next kind of period, what was it like to be, I guess, you know, in that environment permanently? So going from someone who was traveling up, you know, every other weekend or kind of almost having a bit part in to step in full time, what did that look like day to day? And, you know, what was the environment like?
Yeah, so you're all under one roof. So you've got these superstar players that you idolize because you're a fan as well. And even if the players there that weren't fans of the club, you know, they idolized these players. So you're all in the same building. They all know your name, and you're all part of one group. you sit together in terms of eating as well, and you kind of feel like you're part of a family. And that's very much the environment of which was set up at the club, is that everybody's in that together, and everyone's got as much kind of impact as anyone else, whether they're in the first team or not. But the standards are set from the first team players and the way that they conduct themselves. And the structure is very kind of stringent in terms of the training times and protocols. You are there, you know what's expected, and there's high expectations, but it is trying to live up to those each day, which is, yeah, constant challenge. Mm.
So when we talk about some of those players that we idolise, I mean, it might be for some, you know, other people today having to think back a little bit, but yeah. Who were kind of the household names in that at that point in time in terms of the
So I signed as an apprentice in 1999. They'd literally just won the treble. So you had the likes of Beckham and Giggs, the household names, Andy Cole, Dwight York, Yap Stam, Peter Schmeichel, David Beckham. And then you started in the next year or so, they had Ruud van Nistelrooy, Juan Saber Veron that started to come in. Obviously, Roy Keane, which was a bit of a stalwart from the early kind of championship years and through that time, which was an incredible person to kind of watch and train, and the way that he conducted himself was... of the highest standard, and one that you knew you had to try and live up to as you progress through the system, really.
And obviously, I mean, I imagine there's a number of really great coaches, you know, as obviously Alex Ferguson being the kind of top of the tree, but one that got a lot of kind of, I guess, good things said about him, unfortunately, after passing, was Eric Harrison. Did you have much to do with him?
and quite early on as well. We talk about standards. That was a real eye-opener and introduction of what was expected in terms of the training and the quality of what was expected in terms of the skill and technical aspects of the game. So you knew very quickly that there was high standards there, and you were told very quickly if things weren't up to standard as well. So, quite empathetic though, hard, but empathetic. But you knew exactly where you stood and what was expected. So that was a great experience. And you knew from his kind of legacy with the young players that had come through that he was someone that would be able to kind of get the best out of you. Hmm.
So what did the next kind of period of time look like for you in terms of, I mean, obviously you kind of eventually end up transitioning out of Manchester United. What was that journey like? What were some of the challenges and the kind of things you had to deal with there?
Yeah, so the injury that I had as a 14-year-old kind of reared its head again when I was around 17. And then at 19, I had to have quite a major injury, that major operation. To try and rectify it, but it was at a point there where I'd missed so much of my kind of training and development that it was going to be unlikely. And actually the advice was that maybe I should look at retiring and maybe look at another profession because of that, because if that was to break down again, then it would be quite a major thing to have gone through again. To put my knee and a long rehab process in order to kind of get that back and have some kind of career. So that was obviously a difficult time, and being able to deal with those emotions that you kind of, your dream of where you are is essentially over. But it taught me some resilience. I'm quite persistent, so I felt that I could still play, and I still had, you know, a passion to still play. So I wanted to kind of go that route. And Roy Keane kind of said to me at the time that, surgeons can be wrong. And that was kind of enough for me to kind of think, well, yeah, if I feel that I can do it, I'm gonna give it a go and still kind of follow that dream. So I ended up coming back to Exeter as it unraveled, and going to Exeter City and kind of trying to find a way of rebuilding my career and at least playing and getting to some sort of level where I enjoyed playing football again, really.
I mean, that's pretty mega if you're getting advice from Roy Keane, because I mean, you know, number one being the captain, but obviously coming through a very serious knee injury himself a couple of seasons prior. So someone with, you know, not just empty words of encouragement, yeah, someone who's experienced what you're experiencing.
Yeah, exactly. And that was probably it's how I felt anyway, but that was enough for me to really kind of then follow that through. And that kind of gave me the impetus to really go for it. So that's what I did.
So I'm just thinking as well, one of the other names that springs to mind is obviously Mick Clegg, who's someone from an S&C perspective that's quite well known now retrospectively. Yep. So what was the kind of strength and conditioning experience in the academy at Man United? Was there much there or not really at that point in time?
Well, before Mick came in, and Mick kind of came in at that kind of junction, that 99 to 2000 year. And that was the first real kind of introduction of someone coming in to take care of that side of players' development, both with the first team and also with us as the youth team squads as well. So he was kind of covering all that. He had pretty impressive background with his sons that have done really well from a weightlifting perspective. And Mike Clegg, his son, and Stephen Clegg, who was the same age as me, they were very talented weightlifters as well as talented footballers being at the club. And Mike obviously got into the first team and played in the Champions League as well. And then also has gone down the strength conditioning route, being at Sunderland, and is now back at Manchester United. So you could see in those boys, they looked very different to how a lot of us looked. That from a power and strength perspective, they were a totally different animal to a lot of us boys that hadn't had that experience from a young age. And that was really, really clear to see. And what I think Mick brought in was the importance as a way of blending strength development alongside the skill, the technical and tactical aspects of the game. And that was my kind of first introduction really of strength conditioning and developing that within football anyway.
So obviously you then go on to have, you know, continue that career with Exeter City. What was the kind of the difference now contrasting the two experiences? What, you know, what were the differences across context, across environment, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes players probably looked at the way my routines and things like that and preparation, and they probably thought, what are you doing? But that was kind of what was bred into me from a young age in terms of preparation and those types of things. So, yeah, there was probably a professional element that was different, and that probably comes from the standards that were set as well. From an S&C perspective, absolutely none, and that was kind of the first team manager would maybe put things on that, but you were really left to your own devices. If you wanted to do that, or you had older experienced players that had never done that and would never do any of that, even if the manager was putting it on, like, that's not for me, which obviously is very different now. So yeah, there was a real contrast of players that were really kind of into it, and they could see the benefits that would have, and certainly ones that were old heads or experienced that thought, nah, that's not for me. So there was a bit of a contrast there for sure. But it was starting to build it, and the younger players would start to look at ways of training. Not always that great, but at least kind of considering that being a part of the game where they could benefit.
And I'm right in thinking that you crossed paths with Man United one more time, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, that probably the most memorable moment at the club. Yeah, we happened to do very well in the FA Cup one year, and we managed to make it to the third round. And Manchester United was pulled out the hat, which was incredible. And timing for the club couldn't have been any better. They were struggling financially. The supporters had just kind of taken over the running of the club. And essentially they needed that. And it couldn't have come at a better time. And the fact that we were able to get a replay out of that is even more amazing. And the kind of windfall from that of being able to bring them back to our ground and play them again. And then a very different side that faced us that night compared to the original, the first game. But again, another amazing experience of being, you know, trying to pit yourself against those top players and trying to stay with them and catch up with them for sure. But it was a great experience.
So what did your transition out of playing and into, you know, coaching and what you're doing now? What was that journey like?
Well, while I was at Exeter, I used to coach football with my cousin. And I think that that kind of started my journey with coaching, because because of experiences before, I always knew that I would always have a backup plan. And I enjoyed coaching. And I wanted to just start the process while I was still playing, because however long that was going to last for, I mean, always in the back of my mind, is my knee going to break down? You know, is that going to be an issue? Or I know that football isn't a long career. I know that's, and from an early age, that has kind of paid dividends, really, of always being prepared for that. So that was my first kind of insight. And then it kind of came to 1 year with contract, and I was only kind of 26, 27. And I decided, well, I could kick around in the lower leagues and get a year contract here and a year contract there and move around, or I can decide, let's actually transition now, and now is a good time. So I was still young, so I still played part-time, still earned a bit of money that way, and also then just started the degree process and just trying to build my knowledge. And from my experiences of injuries and kind of being in tune with my body, S&C really has become another passion for me to work as a coach in that field. So that's how my journey kind of began. I was fortunate enough to, my wife's a physio, so she was working at Plymouth Argyle at the time, and the coach there linked with a guy called Barry Beasley that ran the S&C kind of program at Crewe Alexandra for many years, and he was linked as one of the tutors with the British Weightlifting Association. So that's kind of introduced me to some of those aspects and those ways of training. So I went and did some of those courses. And then I had the opportunity to, an opportunity came up at Ivy Bridge to help out with the S&C program that they were kind of building. And Michaela Breeze was there at the time that had kind of built a program there, and very kind of well known on the British weightlifting circuit. Sonny Webster has kind of come through that program as well and moved on, and obviously has done very well. So she had a really good kind of pedigree. So to have the opportunity to have started there and look at the way that she worked and coached, and then worked towards gaining my UKSCA while I finished off my degree as well. So that kind of gave me the background knowledge, and then having the opportunity to work with young athletes on a daily basis over the last 10 years has really helped develop me as a coach and working with younger athletes specifically. So that's how I've kind of transitioned where I am now.
So what would you say is your underlying driver or your real passion for getting out of bed to go and coach?
I think my why is from my experiences. What I want to do is to create an environment and a program that can minimize. I know I'm not going to stop everyone getting injured, but at least have an impact on minimizing those risks. And that is the biggest kind of driver for me, is working with young athletes particularly, and putting those things in place for them, and having an enjoyable experience where they see the benefits of the enjoyment from sport, but also having the opportunity to participate and participate regularly, and not have injuries interrupt their process, or as little as possible. Mm-hmm.
So obviously, you know, injury prevention and risk minimization is a big part of your approach, your coaching philosophy. How else would you describe what other components are important to you?
Yeah, so first, do no harm, but also I think creating the environment and educating the students so they have some ownership within the program, there's some autonomy there, because I think that is vitally important as they progress through, and certainly if they progress through into a professional setting where they're going to need to have those skills more and more, and understand what they need to do on a daily basis, and understand what their strengths and weaknesses are so that they can make good decisions on how they plan and execute those things in terms of their training. So I think having that aspect to the program is hugely beneficial, and one of the things that I try to implement in my programs.
So tell us about what is, I guess, maybe pre-pandemic, it's a bit different now, but what does your role look like day to day at Ivy Bridge?
Okay, so role looks like it's between kind of 5 to 7 sessions a day, and that's across different year groups and different sports as well. So our kind of main sports tend to be within football, rugby, and netball. So they have their timetable times to do some technical work as well as come and do their S&C program as well. And then we have in our lunch times kind of a combination of our individual based athletes. So we'll have kind of tennis, anything from tennis to sailing, to judo, and they'll come and follow their individual programs in that time. So we kind of have 5 blocks through the day. We have a lunchtime and then after school. And after school on a Monday and a Friday, we've began to introduce a primary school program, just to kind of start to implement some of the fundamental movement skills and movement competency skills, to try and just bridge that gap a little bit from what we see when they arrive and kind of things that we've seen over the time that we've had to deal with and work on to develop.
Brilliant. That's great that you're kind of extending downwards as well, down into that primary school setting.
Yeah, that was really clear from the start. So as kind of beginning coaching with the students is when we came to kind of coordinative exercise and things like that, they found really difficult. And being able to just coordinate, you know, right with left side of the body, even with a running action, and start to question, well, you know, surely should be able to do this, and that being an issue. So how do we start to have an impact on that? And there's quite a big spectrum there. Some children will come in and be really, really good and really coordinated and great movement skills. So obviously there's an aspect of what parents do and maybe what primary school that they've been at as well. But how can we start to maybe try and influence that? So starting to try and set those programs up where the children would come in, one, experience that environment, but also the school as well and meet some of the different staff. So also from a transition point of view, coming from primary to secondary, they start to recognize staff, they start to make friends with children from other primary schools as well. So they almost start to create kind of a social network before they even get to the school. So that transition is helpful as well. But yeah, can we start to implement some of these skills at an earlier stage that we can start to move them a little bit further forward where, once they come to us as well?
So I'm guessing, I mean, you know, based on your kind of philosophy of trying to create that, you know, inclusive environment, and obviously what you're doing in reaching down to the primary schools, I'm guessing that the program isn't just a performance program. It's a bit wider than that.
Yeah, absolutely. From the primary school perspective, yes. We run sessions from football and rugby and girls active, and the girls active is certainly has quite a cross section of different sports that they can have a little go at. It's also the football and rugby is boys and girls as well. But that's kind of my remit now is how can we, with what we're introducing on the performance program, how can we integrate that more within our general PE curriculum as well? And how does that fit into a sports dominant curriculum, which is what it tends to be, and where and how can we fit these aspects in, and whether that's within warm-ups, whether that's into links into the sport before we actually get to the game scenario, rather than it just being a game and trying to teach within that game. That's something that I am working on at the moment of building that curriculum, that movement-based curriculum, to try to build into the normal PE curriculum, so that gap between the performance and the general PE is much closer.
Mm. So what are some of the sort of standards of the athletes that you're working with? Is there a big variety in terms of county up to national? What does that look like?
Yeah, there is, yeah. With our football and rugby program, they are linked with the local professional football clubs, and rugby is Exeter Chiefs. So we have boys within their outreach program, and there's quite a long list of players that have come through the Ivory Bridge system that have gone on to play for the Chiefs, as well as playing internationally as well. So it's had a good pedigree for producing, you know, good athletes. As well in individual sports, in judo, taekwondo, sailing. We're quite close to the coast, so sailing's quite a big one where we are as well. So, so all the way through that spectrum, from county through to national and international honours as well.
Mm, fantastic. And when these athletes come to you, as you said, there's obviously a bit of a variety in terms of people who have some training age, no training age, yeah, almost maybe some deficits.
Yep. Yeah, so I think one of the key things is trying to meet the athlete where they are, or you know, the young student where they are. That's where coaches, and I've been quite fortunate down here in the Southwest, James Marshall, which I think you've had on the podcast as well, through doing some workshops with James, and he did the European kind of game workshop as well, and that kind of really started to introduce along with Kelvin Giles. I think, you know, we both were at the Jersey kind of conference, weren't we? And that movement kind of rubrics, that curriculum is, I think, a real key aspect for us to develop through our PE program and through our performance program as well, so that those students have something to work through and meets them where they're at and shows them the progressions through of how they're going to develop over that long period of time. And I think this period that we've had with the lockdown has been helpful in some ways in developing things online and building video content. So not only when they're with us at school, but almost like they have their homework and they have some idea of where they're starting from and things that they can work on away from us, and having an assessment tool to be able to show how that's progressed or not progressed, and maybe what are the reasons for that? How much have you put into it? And what are the things that you're finding are difficult along the way? And how can we help that? And that's where we start to kind of shape in terms of our coaching to help them.
Mm. So you've mentioned obviously as well, and it was one thing I wanted to kind of dig into, was that, you know, the overlap or perhaps the gap, as we've kind of, you know, as Kelvin's very articulately kind of communicated around those, that gap of movement skills and the shift from a movement-based PE curriculum to a sport-based PE, you know, curriculum, and some of the issues that's built. Yeah. So you mentioned trying to overcome some of those things. So what are the challenges at the moment? What are some of the solutions you've come up with? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think the challenges at the moment are that it's traditionally, over the last few years, always been a sport-based curriculum. So I think the challenge is, first of all, is to overcome that, as that is the way to run a PE curriculum. What are the importance of movement, and how does that kind of relate to not only the benefits of sport, but just in life in general and health? And I think health is probably the biggest aspect that we can place front and center, especially with what's happened over the last few months, of the importance of that is the benefits of being able to move well, and that opening up many more opportunities for those children to access other aspects of physical activity, and feeling like that they can. Also then the self-esteem and self-confidence aspects that come along with that as well. So if we're not addressing those issues and that not being part of the program, then we're really missing, you know, there's a real missing link there, and disservice, I think, to the children that we have in our care. So if that can be discussed, put front and center, that's the underlying kind of aspect, is health. And then how do we build that into the programs that we've already got? And I don't think you're ever going to get rid of the sport-based curriculum, but how do they blend together? And that's where maybe the starts of the sessions, the build-ups, the warm-ups that give the students continual practice of those areas before they go into, and then how those things link to those games, and having that understanding will help to build that up and make sure that that's part of the process as well.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you said there around, I mean, you know, prior to the pandemic, people, I think, were paying a lot of lip service to, you know, the benefits of exercise, but primarily people were talking about weight loss, weight, like, you know, gain, muscle mass, etc. But, you know, the longer we go in this, the more people, I think, are realizing that, you know, that 1 hour of activity they had was actually a lifeline during the day. And actually those benefits of self-esteem, self-confidence, stress relief, all those things are actually as legitimate as weight loss, weight, you know, weight gain, muscle mass, yeah, etc.
Absolutely.
And it's really interesting because, you know, you're not the first person, I think, to mention that. You know, speaking to Andy Kirkland last week and Kelvin Giles, you know, the idea that health, well-being and performance are all actually the same thing. Yeah. You know, you can't segment performance away from health and segment well-being away from performance, and they're all interlinked. And actually we've gone with our, you know, the PE curriculum, we've gone after sport performance, but actually if you put, you know, health front and center, you will get those other things. And
yeah, absolutely.
Kind of dichotomy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and certainly at our school, we have 2,500 students. It's a really large secondary state school. How many students are on our performance program? 300. So we've got a large proportion that aren't. So where do we kind of place what we're putting into practice, and the benefits are a large proportion of our school. So it should be integrated, and yes, support those students that want to strive and you know, and achieve in a sporting sense, but also what we do to kind of develop the rest of our students and for their health benefits and their long-term health as well. And that physical literacy part and how does that transition and create a physical legacy, you know, for the lifetime for our students.
I think that's really massive, and it's a
It's a big question. I think, you know, that integration, you know, do you tear it all up and start again and go back to a movement thing, or do you integrate movement into the PE curriculum we've already got? You know, there's a lot of, you know, it could be a minefield, but there's a lot of people absolutely. Like yourselves who are trying to answer those questions.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of seeing what works. And if it's a blend, then great. And you kind of get the best of both worlds. But if you see that introducing the movement based is more beneficial, then why would you stop kind of going down that route? And how can you make that even better? I guess that's the question to be answered. So if you're doing your assessments along the way of what impact, and it will always come back to impact, is maybe that'll answer the question for you.
Mm. I think it's interesting, you know, what you've said there about that self-esteem, you know, self-confidence and competence. Maybe that answers a lot of the questions around why people or why kids pull themselves out of some PE things. You know, the classic thing is, oh, I don't like basketball or I don't like football. And, you know, if you dig down a bit deeper, well, I don't like it because I'm not good at it and I don't want to look stupid. Yeah. You know, so it's actually not enjoyment, it's competence that's holding me back from engaging.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we can work on that. There's no reason why we can't work on that and build that in. Mm. How many potential athletes have you missed in that respect as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, 100%. You know, it works across that whole spectrum, doesn't it? From a health and performance basis.
Brilliant. Well, you've obviously experienced firsthand, being a youth athlete in that high performance environment, as well as now transitioning to coaches. So are there any resources, you know, and this, it could be written, could be audio, could be websites, social media, anything that you kind of think is valuable that you would recommend as starting points or signposts for people?
Yeah, I've got a few. I think the first, there's a couple of books that have been interesting for me. The first one was The Definitive Guide to Youth Athletic Strength, Conditioning and Performance. And it is a bit of a mouthful, that. There was a guy called the Youth Fitness Guy that I kind of came across, and he was part, wrote a piece in the book. That's how I came across it. But it's a really good starting point for any coach kind of starting out with working with youth athletes. From a range of coaches' perspectives on what they've experienced over many years of coaching, working with youth athletes. So it was a really good start, and just to kind of have some things in mind, mistakes that they've made and things like that as a good introduction of working with young athletes and things to be aware of. One that James Marshall kind of introduced me to was Physical Fitness and Dynamic Health, which was Thomas Cureton. And from a historical perspective and some testing, there's some really, really good ideas there that work really well. Not a lot of equipment needed and really good that could be implemented into a PE program for sure. Coaching Better Every Season, Wade Gilbert, just from some communication and some coaching kind of checkpoints. I found that really, really helpful. And a little bit off the coaching kind of perspective, but Limitless by Jim Quick. And the reason for that is just the mindset, motivation and methods that he introduces, some really practical tips and a framework for children to be successful, but not only children, but us as coaches as well, because we kind of expect a lot from our athletes being and thriving and being at their best, but what are we doing as coaches to put ourselves in our best position? What baggage are we kind of bringing to the sessions, and what are we not dealing with? So there's some really good things in there, strategies to starting your day and kind of habits to kind of build in. So when you come into work, you're at your best self. So I found those tips and practical applications in there really helpful.
I'm a sucker for a book, so definitely have
you had that one. It's really good. There's some amazing practical tips in there. Yeah, I think the best thing about it is that it's not just telling you what, it's telling you how. We're taught what to learn and what to think, but how to learn and how to think and how to recall and retain information. Important things, you know, for ourselves, but also for people in front of us as well. So if we can pass on those ideas, I think that's beneficial. from some people that follow, obviously Jeremy Frisch, most people will know that, Andy Stone and Greg Thompson. And again, they're from the kind of game network, and James Marshall introduced me to them. There's some really good content that they put out. I think Andy Stone's on YouTube as well. So some good thing. And podcasts, I like the Catalyst Coaching Health and Wellness Performance. That's quite generic across health and wellness, but on purpose with Jay Shetty from a holistic lifestyle point of view. And there's some really good bits in there. And Quick Brain podcast, again, Jim Quick, but again, discussing again some practical tips that are beneficial for us.
I'm going to have to guess and say, if you like Jim Quick and listen to Jim Quick podcast, that you probably also listen to Tom Bilyeu and Impact Theory. Would I be right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. I've come across Jim a few times, but I haven't actually read his book, but I've been meaning to. So that's prompted me, and I'll stick that on the list.
Yeah, there's some really good stuff in there. Really good stuff.
Well, it's been awesome chatting to you and digging into, you know, your firsthand experiences at Manchester United and what your careers looked like and what you're doing now. So thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I know that'll be, you know, both entertaining but educational for a lot of people.
Yeah, cheers, Rob. No, I appreciate you having me on and chance to have a chat.
So where can people find out more about you and your work if they want to kind of follow up with you?
They can find me at my website, which is www.tailormaderehab.com. On Twitter, it's at TaylorMadeRehab, or our Ivy Bridge account is at Ivy Bridge S&C. Or you can just find me on Facebook, Andy Taylor, or TaylorMade Performance and Rehabilitation, which is the same as Instagram as well. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for your time, Andy. Really, really great talking to you.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.